Hey, welcome along. It is 4 p.m. Eastern Time on a Tuesday afternoon in North America. That's the time we usually do these Clubland Q&As, taking your questions live around the planet. Here in North America, we've sprung into summer a little ahead of the fellas in the rest of the Northern Hemisphere. So it's like a little bit of a different time if you're elsewhere around the world. 8 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, 9 p.m. in Paris and Berlin, 10 o'clock in Cairo and Jerusalem, 11 o'clock Istanbul and Moscow, and the early hours of Wednesday morning for our poor Asian listeners, breakfast in Oz, and 9 a.m. in Christchurch. And the consequences of the bloodbath in New Zealand are one of the things we're going to be talking about on our Q&A today. In particular, something I touched on in my Monday column and in my telly appearance with Tucker Carlson at Fox News last night, which is what is now the normal reaction to this particular type of mass atrocity by which the Western world, the political class, and also the media seize on what has happened in order to further restrain freedom of speech. In the Dominion of Canada, for example, the hate speech law I helped get repealed, whatever it is now, 5-6 years ago, young boy Justin Trudeau, our little 12-year-old prime minister, is apparently thinking of reintroducing. We will get to all of that. Before I do, I just want to say there may be a little bit of silence from me in dashes and spurts over the next few days. I mentioned this before, got rather tedious activity in the student loan billionaire Cockwomble Carrie Katz's various iterations of his abusive and malicious nuisance lawsuits against me. There was a deposition the other day. There were some filings in, I think it was Nevada yesterday. We got a hearing in one of the other cases and a full-blown trial all coming up in the next 10 days or so. So I may go away for a little bit of 24 hours. I'm not dead or anything, at least as far as I know. I may be dead and they just haven't told me. But we will not be gone for long. It'll just be some of the nonsense from these lawsuits. And when we do come back, we will be planning various exciting events coming up for the second anniversary of the Mark Stein Club that we hope you will want to be a big part of. We'll also have some more dates for the tours we've been doing, the adorable, deplorable tours with Dennis Miller. We had a grand time in Pennsylvania and New York, and we're trying to rustle up some theatres at short notice to do a few more tours because the chemistry worked, and we're worried if we leave it too long now, the chemistry might just disintegrate and we'll be no good together. So we're trying to find some theatres to rustle up and do a few more dates. And of course, Dennis will also be joining us on the second annual Mark Stein Club cruise, sailing from Vancouver through the Inside Passage to Glacier Bay in Alaska. That's coming up in early September, and we hope to see you on it. Let's get to our questions and see what's on people's minds today. Denise O'Leary, who is one of our sharpest commenters, and Denise says, it's not clear that most people in the Western world today want free speech other than the right to shout profanities broadly when they feel like it. Only a small class who relish ideas really care about free speech, but the fewer classics are taught, the smaller that class becomes. Most Westerners alive today began their lives because mom chose not to abort them and will end them when euthanasia is decided on. In between, government will police and manage them. The good jobs are in government and the big corporations that serve it. There are few jobs in free speech because few see any reason for it. A society does not typically outlive its philosophy, and the West is not outliving Judaism, Christianity, where debates about free speech made sense. A lot of truth in all that, Denise. I mentioned the Canadian free speech battles of, I guess, a decade ago. I think it was 2008. And I remember at the time an Ottawa blogger wanted to have a big free speech rally at Parliament Hill. And I said, it's not one of these, it's not like abortion, for example. It's not going to be one, it's not a mass thing. So we can have a big free speech rally and they'll all be able to fit in the back of my Honda Civic. And it wasn't quite like that. It wasn't quite like that. But there are a lot of people for whom free speech is too theoretical a concept. And what is particularly true is that among the elites, as it were, there used to be, 10 years ago even, I'm talking about these Canadian human rights battles, there was a presumption, even on the left, that you had to pretend to defer to the ideas of free speech, to the concept of free speech. So you would have people at least pretending to observe the alleged Voltaire line that I disagree with what you say, but I will defend to the death your right to say it. I got bored with that line pretty quickly, in part because people who transparently didn't really believe in it nevertheless felt obliged to say it. 10 years on, I think things have changed, and I think in part because of identity politics. That and the whole idea of unsafe spaces and triggering and all that. The idea is that identity group rights trump traditional universal rights like free speech, because free speech necessarily means that you might happen to disagree on some of these identity group issues. So you might say something that's offensive to Muslims or to lesbians or to the transgendered or whoever. And so increasingly, and this is the assumption, I think, of most young people, and actually by young people, I think I mean most people under 50, in fact, that the pieties of identity group politics trump free speech. And it's more important to, with transgender rights, there's one correct attitude. With Islam, there's one correct attitude. With same-sex marriage, there's one correct attitude, and any other attitude is not a different attitude. It's wrong, and it's wrong, and so you shouldn't say it. And if there are enough categories of conversation in which open multiple viewpoints are no longer recognized as legitimate, it soon becomes perfectly normal not to place any great importance on free speech. And as I said to Tucker last night, one of the practical consequences of identity politics and multiculturalism is that it leads inevitably to a more and more powerful state that is the only legitimate arbiter of relations between these groups, which is why Justin Trudeau is proposing to introduce the hate speech law that was repealed 5 or 6 years ago, and that seems very logical to almost anyone who looks at what happened in Christchurch. Now, there's a double standard here, obviously, because yesterday in Utrecht, some guy goes full blown Allahu Akbar on a tram in the Dutch city of Utrecht, and he kills 3 people, and that's already down the memory hole, forgotten. Because as Sadiq Khan, the mayor of London, said, that's part and parcel of life in a big city. Utrecht isn't that big, 800,000 people or whatever. A lot less than that. What am I saying? It's 300,000 people, I believe. And yet it's part and parcel of life in small cities too. Actually, we had a guy go Allahu Akbar in Vermont, in Burlington, Vermont, which isn't a big city at all. And again, that's just part and parcel of life in modest-sized communities in Vermont. This is the way it is now. And as Denise says, a society does not typically outlive its philosophy. And we think that the left thinks it's replaced that philosophy with its new secular gods. And it doesn't understand that's merely an interregnum before something more powerful, such as Islam in Europe, asserts itself. Rich writes, I also said we'd take a couple of Brexit questions, and here's one. Rich says, my wife and I went to Ireland last November, mainly Dublin, and we spent a good chunk of time getting around by taxi. All the drivers were local friendly and happy to discuss all things Ireland. Actually, you know, whenever I'm in a Dublin taxi, I always find the guys always want to discuss immigration, and they're full-blown Enoch Powell supporters. So, which, and Enoch Powell, Dublin was, obviously Enoch ended his long parliamentary career as a very severe and serious Ulster unionist in Northern Ireland, in, I think it was County Down. And he would not have cared for the attitudes of Dublin to most things, but an extraordinary number of Dublin taxi drivers seem to be great Enoch Powell supporters. And so Rich says, being both inquisitive and ignorant, I asked one cabbie a few questions about the Troubles, and he gave a fantastic response with the timeline and details and concluded that tensions are not nearly what they once were. That's as maybe. Actually, there are very few agreed timelines and details when it comes to Irish history. Rich says, I asked why that was the case, expecting something about the Good Friday Agreement. But immediately he responded, it was because we outbred them. All I know is that I've never seen you and that particular cabbie in the same room at the same time. Well, actually, I always make a comparison between what's going on, say, with Islam in Europe and the Irish situation. When Ireland was partitioned, Edward Carson, the great unionist leader, who actually is going to figure prominently in something we're planning to do a little later this year in the Mark Steyn Club. So hold his name, Edward Carson. And he was a great unionist leader in Ireland. And when it came to partition Ireland, instead of taking the 9 provinces of Ulster, he took the 6. He took 6 in the northeast because demographically, he thought the prods couldn't hold the birth rate against the Catholics in those other 3 counties. So there was no point taking them in because pretty soon they would be outbreeding you. I remember Ian Paisley some years ago joking about how the Catholics had always threatened to outbreed him, and he and the Protestants were still holding their own. And it's true, there's like a certain amount of slippage. But actually, it's happening a lot slower than people thought, as far as Catholic Protestant birthrate or Loyalist Republican birthrates, or whatever you want to call it, in Northern Ireland are happening. And I always look at that in comparison to say what has happened in Belgium, where if you go to say Antwerp, and Belgium's I know it's not important to a lot of people, but I think about it a lot because it was my mother's native land, and if you look at towns I knew well as a child, like Antwerp, and the idea that the majority confessional group in grade schools in Antwerp is now Muslim, that is demographically significant. That tells you what Antwerp is going to be in 20 years' time, less than that, in fact, 10, 15 years' time. Because if you have... if you have a majority of third graders who are Muslim, Then in 10 years' time, a majority of your 18-year-old voters are going to be Muslim. That's just the way it is. David Elmstrom says, the irony of the New Zealand crackdown on guns is that the country already has a regime requiring permits, one that granted the crazed murderer permission to own firearms. Nevertheless, the knee-jerk reaction from politicians is always to invent new restrictions on the law-abiding, confident that tyranny against the innocent is certain to frighten future madmen and criminals. I mentioned with Tucker last night that about one in five households in New Zealand owns guns. None of them are connected. This is a very freakish, even by the standards of mass murderers, this guy is very freakish. When you read his so-called manifesto, I don't know what bits of it are just true and what bits are just a giant leg pull. He says he's doing this to sow chaos in the United States, which at one level is completely ridiculous. But the idea that these freakish events, particularly if you look at his manifesto, if you look at these sort of freakish events, people from somebody from Australia going to New Zealand, trying to cause trouble in America, the idea that 20% of New Zealanders who are nothing to do with any of this should have their lives changed for this is ridiculous. But people think it completely normal. And one of the consequences of trying to restrict speech on this issue is that you will necessarily have more violence from guys like this. Even regardless of what your gun laws are, you're going to have more violence. If you have less speech, you will have more violence. Ayaan Hirsi Ali made a very good point some years ago, which he said that eventually, you know, Islam in the context of Islamic terrorism is not really a religion, a faith, a contemplation of the divine. It's actually a very rather old-fashioned imperialist, colonialist movement. It's an army of conquerors, as we saw when Angela Merkel invited all those strapping young Muslim men into her country. And it will necessarily... And then I think I mentioned this a couple of years ago when I was in Finland, where they had a movement called Sons of Odin. For all those who... I met a lot of friends of Sons of Odin and brothers of Sons and Odin of Odin and wives of Sons of Odin. I didn't actually meet a terribly large number of Sons of Odin myself, and I wasn't altogether persuaded how much of a movement and how organized it was. But eventually, if we keep trying to hold the lid on any serious discussion of these issues, there will be a countervailing movement to political Islam, which is a kind of politicized Christianity, as it were, in which people who don't go to church, they're not faithful in any particular sense, they're not traditional inheritors of Western civilization in any meaningful sense, but they will nevertheless adopt the kind of a counterbalancing identity to the Islamic imperialist identity. That, I don't think, will be a particularly healthy thing for social tranquility. But as long as these nutso politicians keep trying to shut down speech, as long as you have these crackpot chief constables, for example, all over England, who's at all the lunatics in Scotland, who take more seriously a supposed hate tweet than they do acts of terrorism, who take more seriously a Facebook post than the serial sex slavery of hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of young women in the towns they police, then they make more inevitable the rise of some kind of countervailing mirror image of politicized Islam. The stupidity particularly of the British police, were, you know, quite frankly, among the most useless police in the world, they make more inevitable violence. And we should actually, we owe it not just to the dead in Christchurch, but the dead in Utrecht, to think seriously about why this is happening. Roy Blair writes, this is a Brexit question. How can you credit the thinking by the EU and the Irish government that declares that a so-called hard border between the two parts of Ireland is less acceptable than the same hard border arrangements to be applied between two parts of a sovereign nation? They mean that this is the so-called Irish backstop, which has been, in a classic bit of incompetence by Theresa May, has become sort of presented as a fait accompli to the British political class and the Westminster Parliament. As you know, there's a nominal border between the two parts of Ireland. It hasn't ever really been real. It hasn't been real at all in immigration terms, because it's part of a common travel area. My daughter and I went through it a couple of years back, and I said, brace yourself, we're coming to the border. And she thought it was going to be like a border like the US-Canadian border, where you have to have your ID and you're asked lots of complete, total, stupid questions about whether you're bringing in any Kinder eggs or bagpipes or all the other nonsense that United States Homeland Security cares about. Instead, poof, it just changes. Suddenly, the signs, instead of blue, are green, and the signs switch from miles in Northern Ireland to green when you cross the border, because there they like to pretend they're kilometres, so because they're sophisticated continentals, and they use the euro numbers on the road. So I think the M1 from Belfast to Dublin becomes the E4738 or whatever it is. And that's fine. I got no objection to that. But it's what they call a soft border, as it has been since 1922, when we had the partition of Ireland. But it's now going to be a hard border, supposedly, between the United Kingdom and the European Union. Because Dublin is staying in the EU, and Northern Ireland, being part of the UK, will be out. And so this isn't even a thing. It's ridiculous. For a start, it takes two people to make a border. It takes two sides to make a border. So if Brussels wants to put a hard border on the border with Northern Ireland, they can do that. The UK doesn't have to go along with it. The UK can say, come on down, yeah, we're not. This happened in Whitefish, Montana, of all places, where they got a big bunch of money under the Obama stimulus, so they upgraded the little border post that got two cars an hour and turned it, dropped the Starship Enterprise in there, and widened the road to eight lanes for a border post that gets two cars an hour. On the Canadian side, they noticed it only got two cars an hour, so they closed it down. So Obama basically built a border post. It's like, welcome to the hotel. You can check out anytime you like, but you can never leave. Any border crossing has two parties involved. And just because the European Union on the southern border wants to impose a hard border, there's no reason why the UK on the northern side has to. And I tell you one thing of that. After about 3 months of that, the Irish, north and south, know they're clever people. They'll figure out who to blame for that. So this idea that that it is going to be the UK that will get the blame for any hard border in Ireland, I don't agree with. Secondly, so bloody what? I mean, most places, there are 200 countries in the world, and most of them border other countries. And those countries figure out border arrangements that suit them. It's not difficult. And the, oh, no, what are we going to do about the Irish border? And the idea that they, you accept essentially the partition of the United Kingdom at the behest of Brussels bureaucrats. Man up, for God's sake, Theresa May. Are you pathetic? This has been, she has created issues that were never issues. And there isn't even anything, I don't even know what she's doing now. John Bercow, the Speaker of the British House of Commons, who is not a guy I like. I regard him a complete pill, and he won't even wear the full-bottomed wig, so he doesn't even look like a speaker. He's a complete poser. I don't care for him one jot or tittle. But he was absolutely right to say that she can't keep bringing her lousy no deal deal back, and expect to keep laying it before the House of Commons. You can't just. That's the way they do things in the EU. You keep holding the same referendum until the ingrate citizenry eventually vote the way you want them to vote. And Charles Moore in The Spectator quotes a famous line that they used to apply to, I guess this is what you call shuttle diplomacy, where the prime ministers and presidents fly hither and yon to come back to their home base with some great deal that they've won by going overseas. And at the time that Neville Chamberlain would be jetting off to see Herr Hitler in Germany, there was during all the Munich Agreement, peace in our time, and all that, there was a line referring to Mr. Chamberlain's tireless efforts in flying off to the continent to secure these deals. If at first you don't concede, fly, fly again. And that's what Mrs. May has been doing now for 2 years. If at first you don't concede, fly, fly again. Pathetic, pathetic to see the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom flying into Brussels to grovel before unelected Eurocrats tasked with screwing over the British people. She returns empty-handed. Oh, no, they said this. I flew to Brussels thinking they were going to give me something, and they said, no, sorry, tough, you're out of luck, we're giving you nothing. It's pathetic. What's interesting is what 40 years inside the EU has done to the British political class's sense of itself. Completely pathetic, completely pathetic. Alistair Menzies writes, there seems to be some change afoot at Fox News. Is it aiming to be a Sky News lookalike, as some have said? How about you and Tucker and some other sound people getting together and doing your own lookalike of CCTV? What is CCTV? I'm not sure I know what CCTV is. Or are things not quite as bad as they seem? I don't really know how to answer it. I'm not privy to the thoughts of management of Fox News, and certainly not privy to the thoughts of Mr. Murdoch these days. I look at it this way. I'm not really sure. I would say, for example, as a commercial decision. The money in conservative broadcasting is being on the Trump train, so that if you make the mistake of becoming a never-Trumper, as Glenn Beck did when he famously smashed his face into a bag of Cheetos and then pulled himself up with his face all covered in orange dust to mock Mr. Trump, you damage your brand significantly. That's why he wound up having to merge his brand with Mark Levin and Carrie Katz at CRTV. Couldn't happen to a nicer couple of guys. It's as I think the evil blogger lady said, it's like some conservative talk radio version of The Odd Couple. And somebody should actually do that. It would be hilarious. And maybe I will, actually, if these bloody lawsuits from that cockwomble keep up. And I think those, but the point here I'm making, Alice, is that I think those decisions are made are made for commercial reasons as much as any other. I love Tucker, and I've said this before, but I'll say it again. I love Tucker's show because most of 24/7 cable news things, by definition, you're on the hamster wheel. Oh, wait, breaking news. Someone's holding a press conference. OJ's gotten in the white Bronco. Oh, let's cross to this. Let's cross to that. And 6 weeks later, none of it matters. And I love the way Tucker... he did a thing last night on the college loan crisis. $1.5 trillion Americans personally have $1.5 trillion in college debt. That's the GDP of Spain in college debt, because these predatory lenders who, under the racket of the whole student loan system here, often actually for totally phony colleges. Like, you know, these things, I think they've gone out of business now. Corinthian colleges. They were a chain of colleges out in the West. That's your first clue, by the way, when you have a chain of universities. Like, chains are fine for, you know, your Taco Bell or your Payless shoe sauce, but chains of universities is an odd thing. Ding, ding, ding. That should ring the alarm bell. So people took out huge, and they had a preferred lender, and people took out huge amounts of college debt for that. And Tucker goes after those big structural defects in our society in a way that most cable news doesn't, and that's very important. Stephen Payne. Stephen actually made a good... Stephen Payne, one of our club members, he made actually a good comment that we fished out and highlighted the other day, because he pointed out the irony of mosques in a town called Christchurch, named after, if my memory's right, it's a long time since I've been in Christchurch, New Zealand, but if my memory is right, it's, I think it's named after Christchurch, Cambridge. Is that right? I think so. Anyway, Stephen Payne says, "Hey, Mark, I've never heard you speak of your childhood. I don't mean to invade your privacy, but I'm curious about your parents and family life. What did your father and your mother do for a living? Do you have any siblings?" Oh, you want to meet my sister? "I've read that you left school at 16. You don't want to believe everything you've read. It was 9. Were your parents supportive of you seeking a career of singing cat songs and guest hosting?" Wow. "I'm amazed I can afford to eat," when you put it like that. "What do you consider your first big break?" "I'm curious as to how one becomes a Mark Steyn, and you seem to be the only one who's done it." I'll say one thing on that. My mother wanted me to be a doctor, and I had no interest in being a doctor. I don't know why she came up with that, but she thought it was sort of steady work. You always had something to fall back on. That was her concern. And she thought I wasn't going to get anywhere as a writer. She thought it was a complete waste of time. And I thought about this actually when Andre Previn died a couple of weeks ago. Andre was a great classical conductor, the preeminent conductor of the London Symphony and the Chicago Symphony. And he was a great Hollywood arranger. He did all the big MGM musicals of the 1950s, like Gigi. He had a sort of modest career as a songwriter, but people liked him as a songwriter, and terrific jazz pianist. He did that thing. I always think it's the all-time greatest vamp, a song called "Like Young." How's it going? Ba-dum-ba-ba-dum-bum-bum-ba-dum-ba-ba-dum, "Like Young." It's got a kind of hipster 50s beatnik lyric to it, as it were. It's like, it's great. It's the greatest vamp ever. In the time when I still had time to do Cat albums, and I used to be in the studio with great musical director, Kevin Amos. And occasionally, when we were talking about how we were going to do a song or whatever, I'd say, "Why don't we do a vamp like Young? You know, ba-dum, bam, ba-dum, bam, ba-dum, bum, bum." And he'd say, "There is no vamp like Young. That's the greatest vamp." And that's Andre Previn. And I remember, I think I was doing some, I don't know what I was, maybe I was 22 or 23, and I was visiting my parents going back home, because in those days, kids moved out before they were 43. It's not like now. So, like, I turned 18, and on the, like, 2 days after I turned 18, you know, my father was like, what are you still doing here? Men have to work. Why are you here? And so I was, I'd come back to visit them for the weekend or whatever, and my mother's going, this writing, it isn't going to work out for you, you know. You're not, it's not, it's, you're just, you'll always be poor, you never get anywhere, it's not there. And at that time, Andre Previn was like a huge star. He was a huge celebrity conductor. Perhaps, you know, the most famous, next to Leonard Bernstein, the most famous. And I was doing some event with him or something, which I don't think I'd mentioned about. But anyway, the phone rings and my mother picks up the phone. She goes, oh, okay, just a minute. Andre Previn for you. And at that point, she realized I was sort of serious about making a career in the things I was interested in. Thank you for reminding me. I don't talk a lot about that kind of stuff. But once in a while, I do. Thank you for that question, Stephen. Sean Saavedra says, hey, Mark, thank you for fighting for free speech. What do you believe is the best overall solution to address the social media 1984 censorship, YouTube, Twitter, Google, Microsoft News, Facebook, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? Actually, there's not as many et ceteras as you think. Basically, Facebook and Google YouTube, which Google owns YouTube and I think Instagram and other stuff. Basically, Facebook, Google are dividing up the planet. So it's not even et cetera, et cetera, et cetera anymore. There aren't any et ceteras. It's Facebook and Google. So that conservatives can preserve their ability to express ideas in polite society. Elizabeth Warren has called for these companies to be broken up. Elizabeth Warren. Right? And I would really like to know where conservatives and the Trump administration are on that. It's interesting. You know, the way it works in America is the lobbyists buy off both parties. And if you go to CPAC, there were more than a few speakers. When this issue comes up, there were more than a few speakers there who get big bucks funneled to them by Facebook and Google, YouTube. And so you need principled politicians here, and they're rare anywhere. But Elizabeth Warren happens to be right on this. She's not right on anything else, but she wants them broken up. And I want them broken up too, because in a couple more years, it's not going to be possible. They will be too powerful. They will have bought up everybody around the world that they need to buy up. That's simply the reality of what we're facing. We see it already now. And actually, what annoys me is that people never get annoyed with Facebook in particular for the right things. This guy in Christchurch live streamed what he did on Facebook. We're supposed to believe that Facebook can't devise an algorithm that prevents somebody live streaming mass murder around the world. But apparently the priority is to stop, Milo Yiannopoulos or whoever. Actually, you don't have to be Milo Yiannopoulos. You can just be some anodyne, you know, pro-life group in Ohio, nobody's ever heard of. Facebook will shut you down. But if you want to live stream mass murder around the planet, they can't devise an algorithm for that. When I was on Tucker last night, I followed an item about these Green New Deal fellas who think the planet is going to end in 12 years' time. That's, I think, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. 12 years' time, I think that's, 2030, 2031? The planet's going to end in 2030, 2031. I'm pretty confident The planet will still be here in 2030, 2031, but free speech will not be here in 2030 or 2031. We're getting slippage year on year here. Things are a lot, as I said, I got a law repealed 5 years ago. That was a small victory to get that law repealed by the Canadian Parliament. But what's happening elsewhere, every day, in countries like England that were once the crucible of free speech, or even in America, what's striking to me about something like the reaction to Christchurch? It's no longer enough to express sympathy and shock and revulsion unless you do it in the right way. I mentioned the Governor General of Canada, Madame Payette, and she issued the kind of statement that an apolitical vice-ren is supposed to issue. And this big-shot Canadian broadcaster, Charles Adler, is suddenly sneering at her because she didn't use the word Islamophobia. Look, we all react to the murder of 50 people in our own way. And the Queen is not obligated to react to the mass murder of 50 people in the same way that President Trump is. When did we think it normal to demand that something that is meant to be as sincere and heartfelt and personal as an expression of grief can only be done in the prescribed way? So, for example, Andrew Scheer, the jelly spine squish who purports to be the Conservative Party leader in Canada, he got it wrong. He didn't mention Islamophobia. So immediately people start saying, why didn't you say Islamophobia? Why didn't you say so he caves and he tries again, and this time he says the approved words. Do you realize, you stupid twerp? You stupid idiot. Do you realize how evil it is? The assumption that we can, that when we are faced with something as sick and freakish and bizarre as an act of mass murder, that there is a prescribed form of words and nobody is allowed to deviate from that? What kind of sick world is that? But no, why do conservatives lose? Why do conservatives lose in America, in Canada, Britain, Europe, wherever? Why do they lose? Because they surrender the language. They surrender the language, just like this guy in Ottawa did. Paul Harmon writes, the Wall Street Journal mentioned today that the Chinese are extending their influence over offshore islands out into the Pacific Ocean to places like the Fiji Islands, the Solomons, and the Marshall Islands. The Japanese famously did the same thing after World War I, and though they denied doing so, militarized those islands to create a network of barriers to a US fleet coming across the Pacific to attack them. Took a long time and a lot of blood to get past those islands in World War II. Given the Chinese militarization of the South China Sea man-made islands, which they denied, do you think they are interested in recreating the Japanese barriers? That's actually an interesting point. The Japanese didn't take those. Fiji and the Solomons were British. Marshall Islands are American. I actually had an interesting conversation with Alexander Downer, latterly the Australian High Commissioner in the United Kingdom, in which capacity he was part of that honey trap for Papadopoulos and the Trump campaign with the young lady from the Australian High Commission having drinks in a London bar, whatever that was. But anyway, before he was Australian High Commissioner in London, he was Australian Foreign Minister back in Australia. And I had a conversation with him back there. He was talking about this Chinese subversion in the Pacific has gone on quite a long time. These are islands that were for the most part, decolonized by Britain in the 1980s. And at a certain point, Australia noticed that China was actively going in there, spreading a lot of money around, buying up a lot of politicians and corrupting the joint. And so Australia adopted a policy of sending people in effectively to stop those islands becoming Chinese satellites. And you do it sort of discreetly. You don't put in a guy as chief constable of the police. You have a local guy as chief constable, but you send him an Australian policeman to be deputy chief constable or deputy chief justice or whatever. So it's done sort of slightly discreetly. And they turned around those the subversion of those islands. And I said to Alexander Downer, I said, oh, that's very interesting. He was telling me all about it. Oh, that's very interesting. Do you have a name for this policy? He goes, well, we tried to come up with a name for it, Mark, but the only one we had so far was neo-imperialism. We're not sure that's going to fly, so we're trying to think of something better. But when you're up against real neo-imperialism, which is what the Chinese are doing there, you have to make serious efforts to counter it. Some of these places, we have members in a lot of these places, like the ones you met. I don't think we got any Mark Sign Club members in the Marshall Islands. We do in the Solomon Islands, Fiji. And we don't want to see those guys go. We don't want to see them become Chinese satellites. And this is people often talk about stability. And there isn't actually anything in geopolitical terms called stability. It's like a placid, it's this time of year in northern New Hampshire, where the lakes and the rivers still appear to be frozen. But that's the surface, and underneath the water is moving. The water is always moving. And if it's not moving in your direction, it's moving in somebody else's. George Pereira writes, Mark, many people like to say Blazing Saddles, the Mel Brooks classic, couldn't be made today because it's, well, you know, a woke version of Blazing Saddles would be a train wreck of other proportions. But what about other movies? Could Fiddler on the Roof be made in today's Hollywood? Well, look, if Chelsea Clinton's tweet at Ilhan Omar caused the New Zealand mosque massacre, which is what those people berating her the other night at New York University were suggesting, I'm sure Fiddler on the Roof will be causing mass murder, genocide all over the world. What about Exodus? Is there any woke actor or transgender or blah, blah, blah willing to take on the role? Lastly, what about Cast a Giant Shadow, Kirk Douglas, Senta Berger? Now you're talking. Yul Brynner, oh my word. Yul Brynner, John Wayne, Frank Sinatra, Angie Dickinson. Wow, now you are talking. All start in the original. Are there any in Hollywood of their stature who would even dare to star in a remake of the movie? My answer is, to all three movies, is no. I think storytelling is fundamentally conservative. I've talked about that before because great storytelling assumes that actions have consequences. I was talking about, you know, 19th century social novels. A girl goes to a dance. She makes the mistake of accepting a dance from the wrong person, an unsuitable man, and her life changes. And in our world, there are no consequences. You wake up on a Tuesday morning and you decide you want to become a woman, you can become a woman. And so liberalism teaches us that be who you want to be, there's no consequences, blah, blah, blah. It doesn't make for interesting storytelling. It's why the Marvel comic universe, dependent on this new Captain Marvel. I don't think that's. I think what's the expression? Get woke, go broke. I think that's going to apply to the Marvel universe in motion pictures. When you talk about comedy, I think that's more interesting. It's, and if you happen to be come and see Dennis and me, Miller and me on our little tour, I'd be interested to hear about that. Because, of course, the whole thing about comedy is it's supposed to be observational. And you get your laughs from the sort of the shared observation and the shared sense of what you're looking at. So observational comedy is a thing, except that now we're not allowed to observe anything because political correctness is actually an apparatus of not noticing the obvious. So if you go, as we were talking about at Stein Online, if you go to Connecticut and you watch the state schoolgirls athletics championship, you're not supposed to notice that the people who the winners and the second place in the main 400 meters track event or whatever are physiognomically men. You're not meant to notice that because it's insensitive because they've got the female pronouns and they've changed their name to Mariana or Elizabeth or what have you, Francesca. They often, I notice the transgender ladies often pick very appealing ladies' names when they transition. But you're not meant to notice the obvious. And actually, that's increasingly, that's why the Homeland Security thing is such a joke. If you see something, say something. The whole organizing principle of a politically correct society is if you see something, say nothing. Don't see it. Put it out of your mind. A politically correct society is all about not noticing. Scott Scherzer writes, "Dear Mark, the massacre of Muslims in Christchurch was sickening. I truly hope that the murderer is put to death as quickly as the New Zealand legal system can muster, assuming they still administer the death penalty." Well, you can forget about that, Scott, because he will be getting life in prison. That's it. They won't be hanging him. That being said, as a Jew in America, I'm not too keen to have Muslims in significant numbers anyway immigrate to the US. They seem to be bring with them the anti-Semitism that thrives in their countries of origin. We see that not only with immigrants such as Representative Ilhan Omar, but with second-generation Muslims as well, such as Representative Rashida Tlaib. I'm afraid that there are some cultures whose values are just not compatible with ours. If there was a good way to determine which Muslims could easily assimilate, I'm happy to have them. If they are incapable of showing gratitude to Western societies that take them in, they can just stay put in the hellholes of their making. Well, I always think it's best not to deny the obvious. I've lived and spent time in places where people openly hate each other. We were talking about Ireland earlier in the show, and if you go to actually almost anywhere in Northern Ireland, certainly in the old days, you were aware that the visceral hatred between large numbers of prods and papists. Because in a sense, the whole sort of loyalists and Republicans thing was only a sort of actually somewhat sort of diluted political expression of that, was genuine and visceral. You could feel it. You could feel it. And actually, people hated each other quite openly and expressed that hate quite openly. And then you had other places I've been to, like Mostar in Bosnia, for example, where Christians and Muslims had gotten on for centuries in many ways and had intermarried and been actually quite relaxed, particularly the Muslims, comparatively relaxed about their respective faiths. And the Muslims would like to tipple, like to, as many fellows in the Balkans do. They can take their booze and they like their booze. And somehow what was weird in the disintegration of Yugoslavia, a mixed community like Mostar, and I remember talking to Bosnian Christians about this, that it was actually one of the weirdest things. A guy telling me the first time he heard Arabic in a Muslim coffee shop in Mostar, the guy said whatever it was, Salam Malakam, and realizing something had changed, and they were now going to be hating each other. And again, it was that was interesting to me. And again, I've been at, like, particularly at Quebec cultural events, for example, where you will have some militantly separatist Quebec cultural artists who actually get all cranky if there's some Anglophone in the room whose French is inelegant, as mine often is late in the evening. But it doesn't have to be me. I remember seeing Charles Aznavour a few years ago. He died a couple of months ago in his 90s. Charles Aznavour, he was French, but he could sing in tons of languages. I think he could sing in 14 different languages. So he comes to Montreal, he sings 14 songs in French, and then he sings a song in English because he happens to prefer the English lyric to the French lyric. And an audience at Place des Arts in Montreal boos a guy pushing 90 because instead of singing 15 songs in French, he sung 14 songs in French and one in English. And so it's interesting to me that there are people all over the world I've known who express their hostility openly. And there's no point pretending it doesn't exist. And what is and yet, for some reason, we pretend that millions and millions of Muslims do not hate Jews. They don't necessarily know any Jews. They haven't encountered any Jews. But nevertheless, they hate Jews. And it is simply a fact that if you have large numbers of Muslims, you will have Jew hatred. And as I talked about with Molenbeek in Brussels the last time we were here, on the Chaussée de Gand, on the main drag through Molenbeek, where Jewish shops had been since medieval times, and then the Muslims become the predominant demographic, and all the Jewish shops go. And I don't think it's worth... can you stop Muslims hating Jews? I mean, I said this shortly after 9/11. I said it's like you can meet very Western... I go around places, I travel a lot, and a lot of time you find yourself in a bar and... you'll be talking like in Bahrain, in the westernized, in the Western hotels, in the Emirates, those kind of places, in Jordan. And you'll be talking to some sophisticated, worldly, what they call Prada Islam. You'll be talking to an uncovered woman, or maybe a woman just in a shimmering chiffon Prada headscarf. Someone who thinks nothing of getting on a plane, going to Paris, London, shopping. A sophisticated, worldly Muslim. And she's charming, she's delightful, she's sensuous, she's amusing. And 25 minutes into the conversation, she suddenly starts going on about how the Jews pulled off 9/11. There's no point being in denial about something that is real. But again, it goes back, Scott, to what we were saying about politically correct society means not noticing. So the fact that Muslims, millions of Muslims, are antipathetic to Jews is just something you are not meant to notice. Robert Coley, MD, talks about the 1971 Pentagon Papers case in which Justice Black commended the noble and courageous behavior of leading newspapers in bearing the secrets of government and informing the people. Since 2016, the media majority has hidden the partisan misconduct of multiple FBI and DOJ members from the people and slavishly served the interests of the governors inside the Democrat administration and party. Do you think exposing this dichotomy would help Americans understand and more aggressively resist the destructive effects of perpetuating this unethical media behaviour. Robert, you're absolutely right. And again, it goes back to what we were talking about with free speech. That one of the depressing thing, if, for example, we had in the United States something like the Fleet Street Press of the 1960s, I would be relatively relaxed about free speech issues. But what is depressing to me is that when anything happens, and it doesn't really matter whether it's something like the Russia investigation or this massacre in Christchurch, the bounds in which it can be discussed that the media determine are getting narrower and narrower and narrower every day. And again, one of the reasons why free speech is important, especially in a time when Facebook is bigger than the New York Times and CNN and the Today Show and all the rest of them put together, when Facebook is becoming the dominant planetary source for news, the most important decision that is ever made is whether this is a story or it's not a story. So I mentioned the three people killed on a tram in Utrecht in the Netherlands yesterday and said it's already down the memory hole. The media decide those stories aren't stories. They don't matter. Then there's a different kind. That's why the Pulse nightclub in Orlando, 49 people killed in a gay nightclub. Doesn't matter. No further lessons to be drawn from that. The father of the killer, this is how unimportant it is. The father of the killer wound up standing behind Hillary Clinton at one of her rallies a year later. That story doesn't matter. The Christchurch story, the media decide those stories matter. They indict us all. They demand action. They've got to be done. And so in a world where you have basically these gatekeepers to the news deciding that this is news, but that's not news. This is important, this is trivial and unimportant. That is why we have free speech. And to come back, that is why we have to, even though it's not a concept that has much purchase, particularly on young people, that is why we have to defend it and argue for it all the time. I said about 20 minutes ago, this thing about the world will end that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez believes in 12 years' time, 2030, 2031, the world's going to end. No. But the civilized world will end because at the rate we're going, in 12 years' time, we will not be doing these clubland Q&As over the internet like this. They'll have figured out some way that this isn't going to happen anymore. I'll be in the middle of the woods with a little generator trying to crank up an old Xerox machine and copy it off in fading purple Times New Roman typeface in order to distribute it through some kind of underground railroad system. That's the way we're headed. I'm not joking about that. I'm not joking about that. What's fascinating to me, and this is true whether you talk about relatively minor people or actually big people like Roseanne, who it's not just that their future is vaporized, but the past 50 years of their career is vaporized too, ceased to exist. You kicked off the rerun channels, the Nick at Night or whatever the hell it is these days. And there's going to be more and more of that, because they're growing more and more comfortable with it. And it's this malign alliance between a duopoly between Facebook and Google, YouTube, and governments. Because governments understand. You don't have to smash up printing presses or have transmitters blocking the BBC World Service now. You can pick up the phone to Mark Zuckerberg and he'll take care of the problem for you. That's not a world we should want to live in. It really isn't. That's why I'm glad we have this club. and I'm glad we get to talk about things. I'm grateful for your questions, and I'm sorry that we, as always, we never get to all of them. But I assure you that we will put some of the best together and do them for one of our video editions of Mark's Mailbox. And as I said, do bear with me over the next couple of days as I got all this tedious stuff from litigious student loan billionaire Carrie Katz and his crappy old faux conservative. What's it called? I forget what he's changed the name of it. What is it? Blaze TV? Whatever it is. Anyway, that's going to be tying up an enormous amount of time. I will see you if you're up early in America on Thursday morning. I'm going to be on Fox and Friends, and I look forward to your company on the Curvy Couch with Steve Ainslie and Brian. And we will see you here next time.